Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. In the early 1960s, Gustavus President Edgar M. Carlson committed the college to recruiting black students as part of his vision for its and the Lutheran Church's engagement with the civil rights movement of the time. Joining me today to talk about that extraordinary effort are two of the individuals who played central roles in it, Bruce Gray, Gustavus class of 61, and Owen Sam Samuelson, class of 58. The contributions to Gustavus over their long careers here loom large in the college's history and cannot be overstated. From admission counselors, they rose to major administrative positions, in Bruce's case, financial aid director, dean of students, and member of the advancement team, and in Sam's case, director of admission and then vice president for administration. Each has received the Alumni Association's Greater Gustavus Award for their distinguished records of significant service. Additionally, Bruce, together with Dennis Johnson, has authorized the important and quite interesting history memoir, Black and Bold, A History of African American Students at Gustavus Adolphus College, published in 2012. Moreover, his efforts on behalf of underrepresented students are honored and continued with the college's Bruce Gray Postdoctoral Fellowship, which brings recent PhDs from underrepresented groups to Gustavus for 1 year of teaching, research, and writing. Amid Gustavus's current efforts around racial justice, efforts given renewed impetus and urgency by the police killing of Mr. George Floyd in Minneapolis, I thought it important to speak with Bruce and Sam about some of the relevant Gustavus history in which they were key actors, as well as about their own paths to and experiences at the college. I have the greatest respect for them both and am delighted they could join me for this conversation. So welcome, Bruce and Sam. It's a special pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome. Thank you. Let's start with backgrounds. Bruce, tell us a little bit about where you grew up and how you came to Gustavus.
Okay. I grew up in Sauk Center, Minnesota, north of and west of St. Cloud. I had never seen black people in person during my 17 years, and I played basketball in high school. We played teams that were all white.
All white.
Yes. Never saw a black person. And I was deciding what to do out of high school. And the choices were go to Korea, and my draft number would come up. So I chose 4 years in the Coast Guard instead of 2 years in the Army.
You chose well.
Yes, I did. I learned lots of things there about blacks and whites.
Is that where you met black people for the first time?
Yes. In boot camp, the top bunk was a Hispanic person. The bottom one was black, and I was in the middle. And I couldn't understand either one of them. Seriously. You know, I was very limited in my English. So there I was. But we became friends over boot camp. And then at the base I was stationed, a black person was wonderful.
So this was...
We were together 4 years.
And you were on ships, I assume?
That's No, I was on a base.
On a base, okay.
Yep, search and rescue base.
Okay, I see. And then where was this? Was it in Massachusetts, New England?
This was in New England. It was on Cape Cod.
Oh, yeah, oh, gosh.
Very busy time for the Coast Guard. People don't know how to use small boats.
Right.
Come and find me, Coast Guard. I don't know where I am.
I believe you, because we vacation Cape Cod, my wife Kate and I, and we see some of that.
Yeah, sure you do.
What did your parents do for a living?
My father was a car salesman.
Okay.
And very ill toward the end of his life. Mm. Died at 53.
Oh, wow, young.
But he was very ill. Could not work the last few years. Mother was a school teacher. She taught in rural schools. And then the city of St. Peter opened a position, and she took it and worked there till she retired.
And then how did you, I assume your dad didn't go to college, right? Your mom was
a teacher. No, she went to a normal school.
Right, like my mother did. Yeah. My dad didn't go to college either. Yeah. How'd you hook up with St. Peter and Gustavus?
Well, a couple of reasons. I'd been here. Howard Holcomb used to bring athletes in, and he could name every one of us. You know, this was big. That guy knows what he's doing.
Was he was the admissions guy?
He was the director of admissions.
Yeah.
And I was in the service, and he got my address from my mother, and he wrote a little note to me every year for 4 years.
Wow.
I said, that guy really wants me to come there. So we did. While I was out there, I met my wife.
Sue, yeah.
And we started a family. I was in the Coast Guard, and we came out here. I told my wife we'd be out here for 4 years, then we go back to New England. All right, she says, let's do it. Dr. Kendall.
John
Kendall, once my professor and once my president. He caught me one day and said, you need to go to graduate school. I said, I had no idea what that was. None. So we hurried through Gustavus 3 years.
Wow.
With some summers. I said, we'd go back to see your parents. I'd go back there to Massachusetts and take a course or two in the summer. And I registered aloud the courses I was taking. I made sure that get credit for that.
Right, no kidding.
Yeah. And it worked out very well for us.
And so what about graduate school? You wound up not doing that, or did you? Did you go to graduate school?
Oh, yeah.
You did?
Yeah, oh, sure. In Mankato, they were starting a new counseling program. So three or four guys from the University of Minnesota came down and started it. Good teachers, made sense. And I got my master's in 2 years. But during that 2-year period, I worked at the security hospital.
Oh, dear. In St. Peter.
In St. Peter as a social worker.
Wow.
I had no social work background, but I had a psych background.
Because you were a psych major.
Yeah.
And almost a biology major, right?
Yeah.
Wow. What was that experience like at the security hospital?
It was not good. It was in an old building, for one thing. It was a prison.
Yeah.
Just like going into a prison.
Right.
And I used to take patients from prison back to the prison from our place.
Wow.
But there's sometimes they were difficult at best.
I can imagine.
Dangerous.
Only imagine.
And it said the asylum for the dangerously insane.
That's what this was on the building.
Carved right in the middle.
Yeah.
It's now all in the museum there.
Right. Yeah, that's part of mental health history we're not so proud of in this country.
No.
What about, and so after that, did you come back to start working at Gustavus after you finished your master's?
Getting ready to go back to New England, as I'd promised my wife.
Oh.
But she didn't know it. I had my fingers crossed when I told her. So Howard Holcomb again was by a parking meter, Sweets Meat Market. I remember it well. He said, what are you going to do next year? I said, well, we're going to go back to Massachusetts to find a job, maybe continue grad school. How would you like to work for Gustavus? I had no notion what he was talking about. He said, you're a little older, and we need somebody in our admissions office. You have to do some traveling, and you have to meet a lot of people. All right, well, we'll try it. And it worked. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. And you're still married.
And I was still married. And Sue decided, well, she had a job.
She was a nurse, right?
Yeah.
RN.
Yeah, RN.
Yeah.
And so it worked out. And I still was going to leave Gustavus one time, though. But our kids were ready for college. And that held us here.
That held you here.
Yeah.
40, however many years.
44 years.
44 years.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Sam, what about you? Where'd you grow up, and how'd you wind up in Gustavus?
I grew up on a farm between Red Wing and Cannon Falls in Goodhue County, a little Swedish-American community called Vasa, V-A-S-A, which happens to be where Eric Norelius is buried, since he founded the church.
Founded the college, too, right, basically?
Founded the college as well. Yeah. Grew up in a family farm where we had cows and pigs and chickens and the kind of farm that doesn't exist anymore. My parents did not go to high school. My dad was a farmer all of his life. His wife was a housewife. And I certainly didn't want to be a farmer. Got out of there. But there were a lot of other kids that went to Gustavus from that area. So I decided, well, that's good. I'll go there. Majored in history and English.
Thank you for that.
And decided to go to graduate school and went in political science to the University of Minnesota. Made the mistake of sort of signing up for a PhD program rather than a master's program. Well, that I soon discovered was not for me, and I got out of there. Mm-hmm. Came back here and worked for Ren and Sylvia Anderson in public relations. Then my secretary of my selective service board in Goodhue County called me. She and I have been in contact over the years, and she said, "You're going to get drafted in 2 months." So I joined the Air National Guard. I did not want to go to Vietnam. Was in the Guard for 6 years, 6 months active duty, and then 6 years of monthly meetings. Then I started working for Howard Holcomb, too, almost accidentally, where he sort of hired that way. He didn't do searches, I don't think.
No.
He ran into me, and he said, "Do you want to work in admissions?" And I said, "Sure." So I did for 46 years.
For 46 years. The was he an alum of Gustavus, Howard?
He's a 49 graduate.
Okay, yeah. What about, Sam, just kind of a tangent. You said you didn't want to go to Vietnam. I mean, were you opposed to the war morally?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was opposed to the war. And, I was scared to death. I mean, there were everybody that could think was trying to avoid Vietnam. One of my duties in the Guard every third Saturday of the month is they gave a test to enter the National Guard, Air National Guard. So you'd get there at 7 o'clock in the morning, and the line would be 100 people standing in line. And my job, as I worked in the recruiting office, is I'd go down the line, and I'd count to 40. That's how many we could test. And I had to tell number 41, "I'm sorry, you'll have to come back next month."
Wow.
It was awful. I mean, they were very emotional.
Yeah, that would be tough. But there's a thread there, recruiting to admission, I guess, of some sort, some continuity.
It was the easiest job I could have in the Guard, I think.
Much better than Vietnam, no question about that. So that's interesting. You both have some military service in your background. What about, I'm curious what your memories are of the college when you were here as students, both what it looked like and professors you had, experiences that stand out. And Sam, do you want to start?
Sure. First of all, Gustavus in the 50s, I graduated in 58. Bruce and I are the same age, but he was in the service. It was not physically attractive. All that's left is Runciman Hall. Ruler Hall's been redone, of course. Old Main's been redone. People came here because it was the church college and it had a good experience, I think, most of them. Although I went through as I served as a class agent for my class. Only 50% of those who entered my class as freshmen graduated, which would be an alarming number today.
Right.
So it wasn't much. And I think one thing that happened is Edgar Carlson, the president, was deep into, at that point, in finding sin on campus. And there was plenty of it. I think not only, and Bruce can talk later about his discovery of wanting to recruit students of other colors, but Edgar did something else that I think he deserves even more credit for. He discovered in 1960 that the high school graduation population in Minnesota was going to double in 10 years. He knew with the campus Gustavus had, we wouldn't make it. So he borrowed money, did whatever he could. I mean, built Christ Chapel, Nobel Hall, the library, Bernadotte Library, Schaefer Fine Arts, dormitories, changed the campus totally, and our enrollment doubled in 10 years.
Wow. He's an amazing figure. I mean, Edgar Carlson, for so many reasons. And really, I mean, today some presidents and boards would freak out at that kind of building, but that really brought the college into the modern age. So
oh, absolutely. And I don't know how deeply they went into debt to do it, because they really didn't raise a lot of money in those days. They relied on the church.
Right.
And the church was about reaching the point where they were going to end their support or cut it back.
Well, thank goodness he did that. Bruce, what are some of your memories?
A bit different. We lived in the hatchery, which is...
Which was what?
Well, we had houses. There's some little houses built there.
Okay.
At the end of World War II. About this much space. But I had a house trailer. I said, Sue, we got to have more than that. So we bought a little house trailer. And we all had kids. Everybody's in the same boat.
Was this on campus, the trailer?
On campus, yeah.
Wow, good Lord.
All by the old stadium.
Wow.
I could shoot pheasants out my back door. My back door. Very rural. Terrible walk across to the campus because of storms. We do have storms.
Yes,
here.
We do.
But we made our own friendships out there. I had a lot of friends on campus as well, but never lived in a residence hall. Although there was a time when one of them opened up for a new head resident, Susan R.N., and we suggested that would be a good thing for the campus. The dean of students, Melva Lynn, said, no, we can't have a male living in a residence hall. So we didn't get that position.
Wow.
So, and we finished in 3 years, so I could go on for a master's.
Did you, I'm just curious about your memories of the faculty. I mean, were there any women on the faculty that you recall?
Not many. Maybe Florence Fredrickson in French, Melva Lynn taught French.
Melva Lynn taught French, that's right.
Yeah, and one in the Phi Ed department.
Mary Alice Erickson in sociology.
Yeah.
There were not many.
No. It's so different.
Mostly men.
What about, and Sam, you were a history major. Who were the members of the history department at that point?
Donovan Lund and Rodney Davis. They were the only two. And there wasn't a political science department. So your other courses in history are from the two. Davis had a lot of notoriety as a professor. He was very good, I thought.
Rod the God, he was called, I think.
Rod the God, right?
Yes, he was.
Rodney was, I think, started at Gustavus the year I was born or something like that. And both Rodney Davis and Donovan Lund were here when Kate Wittenstein and I came. We were hired in 86. We replaced the irreplaceable Donovan Lund, and then Rodney was with us for some time thereafter. And maybe, I don't know, the department expanded after you had graduated with some, and that was partly, I think, maybe Edgar Carlson, too. He raised, it was an NEH grant, I know, that he, National Endowment for the Humanities grant, that helped to expand the faculty. Do you have memories of a particular professor? Go ahead, Bruce.
He exchanged, Donovan Lund exchanged with a professor from Texas Southern.
Yes, I want to ask you about that. Go ahead. Black professor,
and,
right?
Yeah. Wonderful guy.
Yeah.
When I was recruiting down there, and he got back to his own campus, we'd go for breakfast. He put me up in his home. Very nice
that
guy.
That professor, and I'm embarrassed to say his name is escaping, but he was here. But and I think he was involved, I know, with the black students at Gustavus.
Yes, he was.
Creating the Afro-American Culture Club or something like that. Yeah. I did not know any of that until I was doing some research in the archives.
Yeah.
I said, oh, my God, Donovan did an exchange with an African-American history professor.
Yeah.
I never knew that history.
Yeah.
Really interesting. So let's... Do you have memories of particular professors, either one of you?
Well, Kendall.
Oh, John Kendall, sure, in psych.
Teacher.
Yeah.
I worked with him on correcting tests.
Okay.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. John was president of Gustavus when Kate and I were hired, and I really enjoyed my interview with him. I remember it well. I thought a humble guy. I mean, not really, you know, he could have been more pretentious or something, but very warm, very humble in my interview. I really enjoyed him. Went to bat for faculty, I thought. At least newer faculty had a lot of us to his home. Sam, do you have particular memories of faculty?
Yeah, one thing that could be said about the faculty in the 50s, they were so poorly paid.
Oh, yeah.
They could not retire. I had several professors that would fall asleep in the classroom.
Oh, God.
I mean, they were in their mid-80s.
Yeah.
Retirement. It was awful.
Oh, that's horrible.
But they, I mean, they were loyal. Some of them were very good, but there were some of them that were, frankly, very average.
Yeah.
Rod Davis was great. Gerhard Alexis in English was fantastic. Was another English prof, John William Richard Lindemann, who was very good. But there were a lot of just loyal faculty who stayed.
Some great faculty in biology.
Oh, I'm sure.
Art Glass.
Art Glass, yeah. I've heard of. You know, it's funny about that. It's true. Gustavus needs to pay his professors well if he wants us to retire, or we'll be there forever.
There were very, other than in the sciences, there were very few PhDs.
Oh, really? Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's very different now.
Almost everybody was teaching with a master's degree or less.
Yeah. Or less. Yeah. Yeah, that's different now. Was chapel required or not?
Yes.
It was required.
I can tell you a story about that.
Okay, tell.
I would go home across the football field when my wife was doing the laundry, because it was out there, but it was away for the kids.
Yeah.
I babysat.
Okay.
And I was up at 5 in the morning to go out and kick tires on a school bus that I drove. I got that job. And then Sue worked relief shift. So I was called into Edgar's office.
Edgar M. Carlson, the president.
Yeah. And he said, "No, Mr. Gray, when you arrived here, you agreed to what Gustavus would be in his, and that's going to chapel every day." I said, "Well," I explained my story to him. He said, "I'll tell you what, if you go to chapel on Thursday," because I'd go over there on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays.
Okay.
And so Sue could do some things. We went to his home. He always had the graduates into his home in downtown. We go up the stairs, and Edgar says, "You're the reason you didn't go to chapel." It surprised me.
Good sense of humor.
Yeah.
That's excellent.
So compulsory chapel ended when Christ Chapel was built.
Yep. Okay.
Yep, we watched that being built.
Yeah. That's so interesting. I've seen photos of just the physical plant, how different it was then compared to now.
Muddy parking lots.
Right. I mean, I mean,
I mentioned earlier, just off the subject, I need to get this in, that I broke the rules when I was an administrator because I dated students. I dated my wife, thank goodness. Now, of course, I'd be thrown out of my job immediately for doing that.
Yeah.
But it turned out to be a great thing because we've been married 59 years.
That's amazing. What was her major? What was she doing?
She was Jan Swanson. She was an L-Ed major.
L-Ed, okay.
And became an elementary teacher. First in Bloomington and then in St. Peter.
Yeah. Well, yes, you'd have been thrown out, that's right, or worse. The thing that I really want to talk about, of course, is the recruiting of black students, or then we would have said probably African-American students, to Gustavus, which you were so centrally involved in. Can you tell us just a little bit about Edgar's commitment to that? What was it about? What did he say to you? How did he approach you about doing that? This is, what, the early 60s, I guess, 1960?
Yeah, probably 63 or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Frankly, I don't think I ever talked to Edgar about it. Well, Howard Holcomb said, "Here's what we're going to do." Bruce and I, as he's already said, and me too, we grew up in all white communities. I had never met a black student. And so he said, here's what we're going to do. Here's what you're going to do. And that's what we did. We were both very good at following orders. And it's sort of amazing, I think, to this day, you send a farm kid and a used car dealer's kid who've never met a black student south to recruit black students.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's a great story.
And we did it without question.
Were you both, what did you both feel about that? Were you feeling this is some kind of mission, or did you feel some moral sense of, we need to bring black students to Gustavus, or was it just following orders?
No, it was some of each.
Yeah,
we'd interact with blacks, sirs, so on.
Yeah.
But Edgar wrote a letter or a piece, forget which, talking about bringing blacks on the white campuses. And he received letters from the South threatening his life.
I bet he did.
Yeah, that's in the archives.
Yeah, I bet he did.
One of the interesting things, I think, when we think about it, is that the South, of course, was totally segregated.
Right.
There was an organization called the National Scholarship Servants for Negro Students, and that's the exact terms they used. And they would, when they found out that a college was interested, and I think Carleton started at that point as well, they would send you the names of the students. So we'd go, when we went into a segregated high school in the South, we saw the best students. The counselor would call out the best students because we were on the NSFNS list.
Okay.
So we didn't know anybody when we'd go there, but we'd walk in and they'd have however many students that had been recommended to us.
And then would you interview the students?
Yeah.
Let me, several years ago I went to the South on a civil rights tour with my wife Kate, who's a historian, and a friend who just retired from Carleton, Harry Williams, who's a historian, black. And I'll be honest with you, even then I was a little leery of going into parts of Mississippi, just thinking about the history. I'm just curious what it was like. So you had you been to the South before?
No.
Either one of you? No.
No.
Okay. So talk to me about, if you could do that, tell us about how it starts. You get in the car, you just head south?
We went together. We would fly, for example, and Bruce has other, we would fly, for example, to Memphis.
Okay.
And then we would split the city to the black high schools. Bruce would go to half, I'd go to half. I don't know. We probably each would spend 2 days in Memphis to cover the segregated schools. An interesting point, one of the counselor at George Washington Carver High School in Memphis was the wife of Benjamin Hooks, the president of
NAACP.
But he lived in Detroit and she lived in Memphis. And that's what we would do. And after our 2 days in Memphis, we'd go to Mississippi, and Bruce?
The Delta. 70% black.
Yeah, I mean, that's Mississippi burning country. I mean, it's just nasty stuff in the 60s.
Very difficult. And when they integrated, the whites would build academies.
Right.
And still be.
That's right, all white academies segregated.
Tell them about Quitman County.
Quitman County is the poorest county in the country. It was, Howard had gone down the year before and met some of the counselors. That was helpful to us.
Okay.
But we didn't get any students then, but right. his point was, let's meet the counselors.
Sure, which makes
sense. And get them on our side.
Yeah.
And for the most part, they were. If we went there once, we were welcome back again. Quitman County, we've had how many students? Oh, probably 25.
And how many became doctors?
Oh, MDs. Yeah.
Right, I know one of the Crenshaws, right, Greg?
Crenshaw, Greg is from there. So is, all names. He's in Jackson, he and his wife. His wife's a person that, Gustavus graduate.
Okay.
They got a PhD in pharmacy.
Wow.
They built a pharmacy and a new clinic in a black area.
That's cool.
Been there. Wonderful. It's so absolutely wonderful.
So what we do is that Bruce would go down into the Delta. This is Memphis, and now we go down there.
Right.
And I would go down to Greenville, Leland, Yazoo City, and then down to Jackson in those 2 days. And so I'd like to tell my story about my favorite story about Moselle Davis King.
Go ahead.
Yes.
Moselle grew up in Quitman County. Because she was such a good student, they sent her to Catholic High School in Jackson. And she was on the list. I think Howard maybe had met her.
Yeah.
So I interviewed her in the courtyard of this Catholic school, Holy Ghost Academy, and answered a few questions. Basically, she listened and would nod and ask a question now and then. And I remember vividly when we left, I said to the nuns, she's just an incredibly bright person. I said, I'm sorry, I didn't do a better job. The nuns said, she's going to Gustavus. Doesn't matter. And she did. And Moselle and I, of course, have laughed about that over the years.
That's great. And then you're anticipating a question I had, which is, I mean, what were these interviews like? So you sit down with these students. You're making a pitch for the place, or you're just saying, tell us a little bit about what that interaction was like. Well, Bruce?
We talked about snow.
Well, we mean...
And clothing, once they decided they'd like to come up.
Right.
And then we got to the point where we flew people up to see the campus.
Okay.
That was later years, yeah?
Yeah. And we also bused them. We also get in your car and with four guys come up from Chicago, spend the weekend. It's that kind of interaction we had with them.
Okay.
The counselors were terribly important, though. We have a scholarship here named for one of them. He sent, I want to say, 35, 40 students over a lifetime. He's now.
But basically, we were making a pitch.
You're making a
pitch. Oh, yeah, we're pitching. Like
we were there to sell. They were there to listen. They would ask questions. But the connection with NSFNS and the tremendous support of these high school counselors, I mean, they couldn't believe a northern school was coming down to do this.
Right. Well, there weren't many. I mean, there weren't many schools doing. Maybe Carleton, us, and we were, I know we were one of the first to do this kind of recruiting, to the great credit of Edgar and you and the college. I'm curious, so what was your pitch? I mean, why come to Gustavus? It's all white, really, then, I guess, in the middle of Minnesota, and it snows.
Because we will get you into a very good graduate school.
Okay.
Thinking beyond, where are you going to be 10 years from now?
Quality education.
Quality education, yeah. Sure.
So the pitch, so Gustavus becomes a base or a foundation for further study, future careers, et cetera.
Yes.
Yeah. The, what about once the students, well, first, you were recruiting in the South, of course. Did you ever feel afraid at all? I mean, were you harassed?
Chris and I would laugh about this. One thing you don't ever stop in a small town to get gas or to eat.
Huh.
And
yes.
You stay in a Holiday Inn.
Yep, always.
You don't ever...
Don't get a local.
And you don't talk to white people because they know who you are. Your accent gives you away.
Sure, you're from the North.
So you'd feel comfortable, you'd feel safe when you were in the black school.
Yes.
That's so interesting. When we went, not 10 years ago maybe, when we went with our friend Harry, who is an African American from Richmond, taught at Carleton. And I remember we pulled into a gas station, it was at night, in one of these small towns, to go to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
The bathroom's inside, and there was an outhouse, or a porta potty, whatever you call it, outside, to which our friend was shown by the white gas station attendant. And he was angry, our friend, rightly, and we left. And that was maybe 10 years ago, right? So, I don't know, you were either naive, brave, or both, but it sounds like you had a strategy.
You never asked directions.
No.
Yeah.
I remember.
I remember a couple of incidents on that. Twice I got lost, once in Houston and once in Chicago. I got lost in a black neighborhood. But I didn't dare stop and ask anybody. I just kept driving until finally I'd recognize a street and do it because you didn't dare tell them who you were.
No.
So you were recruiting in the North, too, it sounds like, Chicago. Where other cities other than Chicago?
New York.
We did the same thing. When we go to Memphis, we'd go together. We'd go to Atlanta, split the schools in Atlanta, and then you would go down to Savannah.
Yeah.
And I went down to that town on the very southern border where the two brothers were from.
In Georgia?
Hmm?
Was it in Georgia?
It's in Georgia. Very southern town.
Hotel Kingstown?
No. Because you'd go to Savannah, and I'd go down to this other town, and then we'd come back.
I went along the coast.
And then we'd go to Houston, do the same thing, split the schools and do that. We never went to Florida. We never went to Alabama.
No.
I went to Birmingham once.
Birmingham.
Didn't work.
What about, so you went to Chicago. Did you say New York as well? New York?
Mm-hmm. Mark did.
Yeah, I went to New York, I think, once. Here's a kind of funny story. I went to a College Board National Meeting in the Waldorf Astoria.
Okay.
And I had made contact with Pastor James Gunther, who was at a black church in Harlem. And he invited me up there. So on a Sunday afternoon, I went out of the meeting, and the fourth cab driver I talked to agreed to take me. The first three turned me down. So the black cab driver took me up to Harlem.
I believe it.
And dumped me off at Transfiguration Church. There was Pastor Gunther. And we took a walk around Harlem. And he said, how do you feel? And I said, well, I'm with you. And he said, do you feel alone? I said, yes.
Yeah.
He said, that's how our students feel when they go to Gustavus.
Yeah, wow. That's powerful.
It was a powerful lesson.
That's powerful.
Only got a couple students out of New York, but Chicago, we did the same thing. We go down, split the schools, spend a week there, cover the south and west side, right?
And, of course, you're doing all this, it's obvious, but it's important to remember, without cell phones. I mean, there's no way for you to communicate with one another as you're splitting up.
I'm driving down on the Delta and stop for directions. Maybe the first time I went down there. Minnesota plates on the car.
Oh, great.
And that's another story. That we'd fly and try to get a rent a car, and the first car I rented had Minnesota plates.
Oh, my God.
Lend-Lease was the company was sending it down to New Orleans.
Oh, jeez.
One thing that we thought we should get in as a story is the high school concerts were so powerful.
Yeah.
In terms of direction. I mean, they were sort of the guiding light for these students.
Right.
But there was a woman at DeSable High School, a white woman, Irish woman.
In Chicago.
We got a lot of kids from DeSable.
Yes, we did.
And she was tougher than nails. And I was in there, and I saw a bunch of students and thanked her. And she said, by the way, we got a card the other day from this student, and I didn't see him here. She looked at the card and she said, Owen, I'll give you a little lesson right now. You're not going to get that student. That student's going to Carleton. You take the students I give to you and be happy with it.
Huh. Wow.
I said, yes, ma'am.
Oh, they have a lot of power.
I can't remember her name. She was a little Irish woman.
Yeah.
And she was tough. But she controlled where they went.
Yeah. Right. So the counselors were key. They were the conduit.
Oh, really. Yes.
I'm just thinking about how much you both learned, not only about recruiting, but just about that history, that time period. I mean, you're really in the Delta when things are bad, right? I mean, civil rights workers are being murdered.
I did stop to ask direction, and he says, what do you want to help those niggers for? I was looking at the high school.
Yeah.
Couldn't find the high school. Paul Rucker... was discovered in Quitman County.
Yeah.
We have a scholarship named sent lots of students to us. And Sam suggested quite a few MDs out of that little high school.
Yeah.
One microscope.
In the whole high school?
There. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I took students along, black students, to travel with me.
Oh.
And I'd then leave the room. I'd present, and I'd leave the room, and he or she would be able to tell them what they thought it was like.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, this leads to my next question. There's the recruiting part. Then those students are here, right? And I'm thinking about what some of them at least must have felt like, no matter how comfortable you tried to make the place sound. I mean, they really still are very few. maybe they felt alone, Sam, to come back to what you said. But what did you individually do, or what did the college do to try to help the students?
Bruce had a real lot. Bruce and Sue really took over.
Yeah.
We did. Into our home.
Okay.
4th of July, we'd have a big party on our back porch. And I'd say, what would you like to eat? Well, we want our ribs. We'll burn them. I said, any fruit? Watermelon. Oh. They didn't want to go down and buy it at the store. They had us pick it up. And we had a very good spitting contest with seeds. and graduation time, when their families got here, that was the only time they were here. Huh. Then we'd host them also at our home.
Did the black students go back at holidays? Or did they
Yes,
stay?
They tried
they
to,
yeah.
But they didn't go back to work.
Yeah.
We found jobs for them here with the county road, working in ditches and doing that kind of stuff. They also worked at McDonald's, and we had one young lady that stayed the summer with us. because she couldn't find a job in Mississippi, in Quitman County.
Quitman County.
And she, we had a bike, so we took that bike out and said, here it is. You can bike to your job. It's bad weather, will take you. And then she'd come back and go to Hardee's and work a second shift there.
Wow.
To save money for her for the next year. One student was pregnant, married. They married here in a church here in St. Peter. Sue, being the nurse, was with her when she had her child.
Wow.
Yeah, and so we got to know them very well.
Very
we
well.
Still interact with them often. Sue's name is in the middle of Consuela's name.
Huh. Sweet.
Occasionally the students would go home, and not very often, and become radicalized. Remember there was the young woman from Baltimore who was just, you had recruited her, she was a great person. She came back for either her sophomore or junior year, and if you don't remember this, I do. Bruce went up to say hello to her, and she spit in his face.
Oh, God.
She'd been radicalized.
I mean, this is the time not only of, I mean, the civil rights movement we think of with King, but it's also the time of the rise of Black Power.
Yes.
And,
sure.
Yeah, so do you have a sense of, and I've interviewed some Black alums and will continue to do that, but I'm curious from your perspective, what, I mean, do you think the students felt comfortable, or were they protesting? I mean, was it just an individual act like that? What was it like, you think, from your perspective, for the students?
They were put upon.
Put upon.
Go down to the women's ready-to-wear back then, and they wouldn't let our students try clothes on.
Mm.
White students could go there and have.
Yeah, down that's insane.
Haircuts. I mean, name all the things that we take for granted.
Yeah.
We'd take them to Mankato so they'd get haircuts.
Huh.
Got to know a Black barber down there very well.
Yeah.
I think it was a very difficult time for most of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Phil would be a very good source of.
Right. I've talked to Phil.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Recorded with him. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can remember once Phil said to me, you know, Sam, I would look for you on campus because you'd smile and I'd feel happy for just a minute.
Mm. Yeah. I try to imagine what that would be like to be one of a few Black students. And no Black professors either at that point.
No.
Really no Black anybody on the
no
staff.
No Black anybody.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I had a fund, though, in my office when I became dean of
dean
students.
Dean of students, yeah.
I had a fund that a sorority started with $1,000 called the Concerned Students Fund. The only two people that knew about it, Ross Bloomquist in finance, myself.
Huh.
I kept records for myself, but no one knew about that. And then pretty soon the word got out, and if students' father died, we'd fly them home. You had to have that kind of money. Edgar understood that, too. So
right.
Then we started funding it ourselves. And we had a fair amount of money in there. And I would say to the students, someday when you've graduated, give something back to that fund, because it's helped you now.
Right.
Maybe that's a wrong example, funeral. There were lots of other reasons.
Well,
my brother was killed, and lots of that kind of stuff going on for those kids.
Right. I think without that kind of infrastructure, without that kind of support, then it's almost cruel to say, come to Gustavus,
exactly.
And you're on your own, and we're not
going
to help you. What? And this leads me to, I don't know if you have memories of the Demos Project, which
Rob Davis.
Yeah, controversial. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? What's that about?
Yeah, it was Rod Davis and Elmer Sudeman, I think.
Yeah.
In English? Elmer was in English, yeah.
And I, actually, we were. I did a lot of recruiting for that, and I was not totally happy about it because they developed the program, took a lot of credit, and said, now go find the students.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent, you know, time in the American Indian Centers in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And it didn't really go at all. I mean, they were, either I didn't do a good job, there wasn't much interest, and we didn't enroll a lot of students. Of course, Phil was one of them from Chicago.
Right.
There were only two students who ever graduated. There was a young woman
nursing.
From Minneapolis.
Nursing.
Who did graduate. It was, I think, a noble idea, but it didn't work.
And what was the idea?
We had a grant for it.
You had a grant for it.
Yeah.
And the idea was to supply funding to these students? Or I know there were, from what I read in the newspaper at the time, there were protests by white students around this, and from parents, too, I guess, of white students around this project.
And you didn't have to be a high school graduate.
No. Okay. You could sleep till 9 or 10 in the morning.
Yeah.
Finally got alarm clocks for each one of them.
And it was sort of the aftermath of most of our recruiting in the South and Chicago. I just want to say one thing about the recruiting in the South, because it's another one of vivid memory. I was sitting in Greenville at night, and I don't think the motel had a TV, but I could see across the way into another person's room. Couldn't see them, but I could see the TV. And there was a basketball game between Ole Miss and Alabama, 10 black starters. And I said, we're done. We're done in the South.
They can go.
Once they could go to the big universities.
We're done. That's when it changed.
That's when it changed.
Yeah.
Oh, they had little ones, Tougaloo and some of the little black liberal arts colleges.
Right, because there's a point where, you guys correct me if I'm wrong, there's a point where the number of black students rises dramatically, but then because of what you just said, Sam, starts to fall off.
And makes
recruiting even more necessary and challenging. What when you think back on your long career as a Gustavus, and I mean, wow, stuff you almost embody the history of the college together. What are the things that you're most proud of? I assume probably this recruiting is near the top, if not at the top. But take that question however you want. When you think back on your careers, what are you most proud of? What did you find most rewarding?
Well, one thing, we'll let Bruce go first, but one thing I'd say, that whole recruiting effort changed our lives. Mm-hmm. We were not the same people.
We were two liberal guys, Sam used to say.
Yeah.
And we really changed even more.
Yeah, that's a profound point.
That's expensive.
It not only changed the students who came, but it changed your lives as well.
Yeah. And we still interact with the students.
Right.
Talmadge King, Harvard Med School.
Who was on the board of Gustavus.
Yeah, he's on the board. Still is,
yeah.
And his wife, we've known forever. Well, Sue was with her when she had her baby.
And there were several others on the board. There was a woman, from DuSable, Young.
Yep, another doctor, another MD,
It's an interesting side lady. We never made great headway in Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Mm.
Minneapolis Central, and she was on the board too, Flippin.
Yep, Dina.
And her brother. And a lot of the students we recruited were families. We had brothers and sisters would come.
Yeah.
Right, almost like a chain migration.
Yeah.
We never quite really hit in the Twin Cities to any great extent. Never made any success in North
Carolina. Any ideas why?
Well, they had other options.
Yeah.
It was one. Maybe knew that we were... students in the South didn't know how rural we were. Students from the Twin Cities knew how rural we were.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point.
And I want to start before Bruce answers the rest of the question, my Jerome Delpino story.
Oh, yeah.
Jerome graduated in 68 and came back for his 50th reunion in 2018. And we were talking, and he lives outside of Nashville. And he was from Central High School in St. Paul. And we were laughing. He said, Sam, don't ever say that you recruited me, because you didn't. He said, my dad said to us, you are going to Gustavus Adolphus College. That's the only place I will pay. And he was an African Methodist minister. Jerome, to this day, does not know why. But he and his brother and sister all came to Gustavus because it was the only option.
That's amazing.
And Jerome and I still laugh about it.
So he's right. You cannot take credit for...
I didn't take credit.
And aside on him, we had peace studies just beginning.
Right.
And five of us, John Kendall among us, myself, someone from the English department, not English, a teacher, doesn't matter. But five of us went out there. When they were busing into South Boston for the first time.
Oh, yeah, sure.
We put on sweatshirts and jeans and went into the bars in South Boston.
Oh, my God.
And those people were mad.
Holy cow.
They were very, very mad. Jerry was a pastor in Dorchester.
Yeah, Dorchester, yeah.
And he'd go with the little kids. He sent little kids. These weren't high school kids. These were little kids in a bus. And I have a photo of the police on motorcycles and dogs and et cetera, and hollering and screaming and calling them everything they could think of.
Yeah.
Well, we came back and did a session for the faculty and for the campus, but I've never been. That was dangerous.
Right. That
I've been in dangerous, but that was very
well.
Dangerous.
People, that's a really important point also because people associate Jim Crow, with the South,
that's
but it's
right.
in the North as well.
Oh, yeah.
And having gone to school, graduate school at Boston University during the busing crisis in South, I was afraid to go to Southie. I went once. And boy, it was like, as you said, pulling in one of those small towns. They knew I didn't belong in Southie. How I talked, how I looked. And I was literally afraid.
Yeah.
I mean, so the violence was unbelievable during that crisis. Worse maybe than anything you'd probably worse than anything you experienced in the South, I'm sure.
Yeah.
What are you most proud of, Bruce, when you think back on your career? What stands out?
Having those students call me. And talk.
Yeah.
Some are thanking me. Some are just talking about what they're doing now.
Yeah.
And they're successful.
Yeah.
There are many, many successful Black graduates.
Right. Yeah, some of whom I've interviewed for the podcast, and I'll be interviewing more.
Yeah.
Just by way of conclusion, I wonder if you could both reflect on, as you think about Gustavus now, as you look at Gustavus now, what you feel, what you think, as not only alums, but as two individuals who've had such an impact on the place in so many ways. And I know that's
the kids are outgoing.
Mm.
They interact. Watched them the other night at the ball game.
Yeah.
You know, they care about each other.
Right.
Yeah. Sometimes making jokes about each other, et cetera, but means good friendship.
Yeah, yeah.
They're bright.
Yes, indeed.
These kids are bright.
Yes, indeed.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sam, what about you?
Well, you know, other than the physical part, which of course has changed tremendously for the better, Gustavus got better academically, became more national.
Yes.
Great spirit. I guess what I think of is, you know, it was sort of there were a lot of opportunities, and it was lucky to be part of that. When I was vice president for administration, which John described to me as being vice president for enrollment with admissions and financial aid and athletics, which he threw in there because he was tired of having the athletic director report to him. And I thought that was a great opportunity. I was never an athlete, but I love sports. And so I was, for 25 years, I was in charge of athletics.
And you didn't play sports at Gustavus?
No, I never played sports anywhere.
Well, that's great.
I mean, other than, you know.
Yeah.
No. And so... It was an opportunity that probably didn't exist anywhere else, and let me brag for just a little bit.
Please.
I got elected to the Athletic Hall of Fame.
I saw that.
it was a land of opportunity in many ways. Presidents were generally forward-looking people. Ed Lindell was a forward-looking person. So was John. John, I used to tell my wife, I mean, if there's a shit job coming up, John will find it for me. We didn't have a human resources program at that time. And so John wanted to change the benefit plan for the college because the medical benefit plan prior to that was 100% family coverage for tenured faculty and key administrators, nobody else.
Nobody else, wow.
And of course it was killing us financially. He wanted to open that up to everybody, and he did. But he said, well, you're going to have to be sort of out there I can't be fencing with these people all the time, so you're out there taking the crap. And he was very good about that, and it happened. I mean, changed it. He also changed the whole pay scale for support staff. So it was a way, there were so many opportunities, and then enrollment, and I had really good people in admissions that we worked together in financial aid. Paul Austin, the financial aid director who followed right. Bruce, was a fantastic person. Yeah. And was also very active in recruiting. But there were, if you had a new idea, it wasn't put down.
Right. I have to say, this we'll end here, because I think what you just said, Sam, is exactly what I feel about Gustavus. The word opportunity is key, and that applies to students, but also to those of us who work here. And this podcast is an example of opportunity.
Yeah.
I mean, if you had said to me 5 years ago or 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I'm going to be doing a podcast, I would have said, what's a podcast, first of all? And here we are. And I think that has helped the college move forward. I think we have had forward-looking presidents.
We've been lucky that way.
Yes, we have. And people like you and Bruce and so many others who've worked to make this place.
Mark Anderson at admissions, I remember one time in the early 2000s, maybe 20 years ago, we were sitting talking, and I said, why do we require an application fee? Why do we require students to apply for something we want them to do? Eliminate it. Now, of course, no one has an application fee anymore. Everybody eliminated it, I think, just about everybody. And then we got into another discussion at a point of saying, why do we require SAT and ACT? All it does is put down the kids who are really good students who can't test well.
Right.
And let's eliminate it. Let's make it optional. So we in Lawrence were among the first two schools.
I know you're among the first, yeah.
To do it.
Yeah.
And now
everybody does it. It's routine.
So there was always, and you have to give a lot of credit to the presidents of Gustavus who were always, I think without exception, or maybe one exception, we're receptive.
Yes, I agree. I'll leave it there.
We'll leave that there.
Yeah. This has been a pleasure. It's just been a pleasure. There's so much to learn about Gustavus. Even though I've been here 35 years, I'm still learning more. And I've learned something about each of you, which is fun part of the podcast. So thank you for all that you've done for Gustavus. Thank you for being patient. Thank you, Matthew Dobosinski-Dobo, for helping us record this, make it happen. And take good care.
So let me say one other thing.
Sure.
Thank you. Is that I don't think we've stressed enough that Bruce and I were a team.
Yes.
We always worked together. We traveled together. We did everything together to make it go. And it was great to have a friend like that that you could always count on.
Yes.
Likewise.
Yeah. I cannot imagine doing. It's hard for me to imagine doing what you did as a team, but. Impossible to imagine doing it alone.
When we split, we were alone.
True.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Craig, for this.
My
it was
pleasure.
A unique experience.
My pleasure.
Yeah, it was good.
And Bruce, take good
Fun.
Care.
Fun.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosinski of the Gustavus Office of Marketing, Gustavus graduate Will Clark, class of 20, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.